Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we, as usual, have many interesting interviews to share with you. I'm starting with, I learned a lot, and I really enjoyed a lot, about bison. We should all be eating more bison, I've decided.
We should certainly be doing that, and because we need a lot more bison so we can eat more bison.
Right.
And bison can run fast. And bison are dangerous animals.
They are.
Didn't a lady just discover that?
Kathy Lund. She really knows.
Didn't somebody get run into by a bison not too long ago?
No, I don't remember that.
It was in the paper, I think.
Oh, dear. This
to be careful.
Kathy Lund is who we're going to be talking to, of High Plains Bison, Golden Bison, which is a combination of company names, she will explain to us.
And guess what, listeners? It tastes really good.
It's yummy. I'm drooling just thinking. You know, there are a lot of things that are really American. and here's one of them, bison. We're going to be talking to Karen Lund about, we're going to call this High Plains Bison, but she can explain the structure of the organization surrounding, what do we call it, how do we describe what you're doing? You're establishing an association and you're promoting bison for many good reasons. We had two of the tastiest steaks that I think I've had in my life, and they were lean and wonderful from your place. I mean, your organization and place. Let's start us at the beginning about the bison industry. We used to have a bunch of bison, and you see them in old Wild West movies. The Indians liked them, right? Or Native Americans were calling them. But then what happened, and they fell out of favor, or they were almost exterminated. Give us a little brief elevator talk here on the history of the bison industry.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So really, towards the end of the 1800s, there were less than 700 bison here in the North America, actually.
Oh, wow. 700.
And so they were truly almost extinct, and this was really as the white man, so to speak, went west, that they, you know, pretty much slaughtered the bison.
They slaughtered
today
them.
There's close to 400,000 bison in North America, so there's been a very strong effort to bring the animal back.
Why did they shoot them all? I mean, they didn't eat them, did they? I mean,
they grazed.
I'm not the best person to talk about this, but I believe that the primary reason was for the hides. Yeah, so you see, you know, they didn't even. I mean, the Native Americans actually really honored the bison, and they are a big part of bringing the bison back into North America. I mean, it's an honored animal in their tribes, and they have quite a few organizations that are working to have Native Americans raise bison today.
Well, Ted Turner was one of the... He was a hero.
He's one of the Native Americans, right?
You're right.
In a different way, yes. He became very enamored with the bison, and he has large tracts of land. I believe he's the largest private landowner in the United States.
And that's in Montana.
He has dedicated a lot of his land to raising bison.
Well, you're not in Montana. Where are you?
Our company is located in Denver, Colorado. We own three ranches. We have one in Montana, one in Wyoming, and one in southern Saskatchewan. So the reason why our brand is High Plains is that all of these areas are, native High Plains, which is really where the bison thrive best.
What's the right word? Is the right word bison or buffalo?
So we ourselves, as well as the National Bison Association, do call it bison. The scientific genetic name is bison bison. And the reason is for that is, I mean, they are interchangeable. You can call them buffalo or bison, but there are organizations that are trying to bring water buffalo into the United States.
Oh, I read about that. They want to make mozzarella. That's
and it's a very, it's a different animal. It's a completely different breed. And so we, you know, prefer to keep those two separated.
Oh, yeah. We didn't we interview somebody?
We discovered something. Discovered something very interesting about water buffalo, which are just referred to as buffalo. One of the largest one of the largest concentrations of buffalo is Colombia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they brought and the water buffalo were brought in to be able to help with the clearing of the native forest. Which existed in Colombia until they got water buffalo to pull it all down.
Oh, all right. I did not know that.
Well, anyhow, so I heard about this effort to expand understanding and consumption of bison products when someone sent me a press release about the formation of the National Bison Association.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is where my interest started. And then I sort of lost track of what was going on. What is happening now? What's current?
Yeah, the National Bison Association, of which we are a member, is dedicated to, you know, promoting bison, and it really focuses on trying to get more producers into the industry. They currently have a campaign called Bison 1 Million, and the goal is to have 1 million bison in North America by the year 2027. So as I said before, we're at 400,000, so it would probably be another 600,000 to get there.
Now, just to scale that, do you have any idea how many steers there are?
I do not.
Well, that's short
and sweet. They would be called bulls. Yeah.
I was trying to use an appropriate word.
No, they're bulls.
He's a silly boy, you know.
No, interestingly enough, listeners, the answer is probably like 100 million or even more than that. So bison's got a long way to go.
Oh, as far as cattle mean, yes, this is a very small, you know, kind of niche category compared to the beef industry.
But it's important, so, right? It's important.
It's a very important industry. I mean, the nutritional benefits are significant.
Tell us about
and
that.
Pardon me?
Tell us about the nutritional benefits. You should be on point for this now. With everybody's interest in nutrition, it should be a boost for your efforts.
Yeah, it's one of the, you know, primary benefits. I mean, obviously, taste is always going to be number one, but health is a close second, and it's one of the things that bison has a significant difference over all the other animal proteins. So it's about, you know, 45% fewer calories than beef. It's 87% less fat than beef. And it's even less fat than chicken or salmon.
Really?
So it's one of it's a very lean cut of meat. It has a good protein content and almost double the iron in any other, animal protein. So it's a very strong, healthy alternative. And because it's so lean, you actually don't need as much to eat. You fill up quicker because it's so lean. So you don't need a huge portion of it to feel satisfied.
You need to know how to cook it.
Yeah, that's the next thing. We must put that pretty much right up front, because somebody could spoil their latent interest in bison just by cooking it like a steak the first time they have it, and then they never buy it again.
That's true, and that is one of the issues with the bison industry is, ensuring the best quality and also how you cook it. So I'll talk about the cooking first and then the quality second.
Okay.
When you cook bison, especially steaks, when you cook a steak, you really want to undercook it. You want to cook it rare, as you would for a beef steak. And you cook it the same way. I mean, you can cook it on the grill. What we like to do here is, you know, you salt and butter, or salt and pepper it. You put a little butter in a hot pan, typically a heavy pan like a cast iron or something.
That's what we did, yeah.
And then you cook it. You know, you fry it up and you cook it as you would a beefsteak, but you want to make sure it's rare. And then what you do is you take it off of the pan, cover it, and let it rest, almost double of what you would for beef. So generally about 5 to 10 minutes. So you feel like, oh my gosh, it's such a long period of time. But that's really when the juices come in, and that's the best way to eat bison. It's so tender and moist and just a great taste that you really don't even need. I mean, you can eat it with just a regular standard knife. You don't need a steak knife or anything else because it's so, you know, it's just so juicy. The flavor, a lot of people think that it's going to be, when they look at the animal, they think it's going to be fatty, but it's not. They also think it might be gamey. But it really has, in my opinion, kind of more of a sweet, robust taste. And at this point, you know, I think it has so much more flavor than beef.
I
so
do,
it's,
too.
It's a very pleasurable eating experience. And then for, you know, ground beef or ground bison, you can use that interchangeably as you would for in beef. I mean, in my family, we use it for tacos. We use it in spaghetti. I mean, we use it for just whatever I would use, a regular ground beef. And it's also great as a hamburger. But again, just cook it a little bit rare. If you overcook it, it's not that it's going to get tough or anything, but what it has such a high iron content that the iron comes out, and then sometimes people, that's an objectionable taste for some people. And so, as you say, they try it once, and then they don't come back.
Yeah, the most like, probably, if you're looking at meats, would be venison and elk.
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Yes, I agree. And the only difference with venison is...
it's gamier.
It can be much stronger flavor, yes. So but the cooking process is probably similar, but the flavor profile of venison is much stronger than bison. Bison's sweeter.
No, I just use the term most like. I didn't say exactly like.
Yeah. Well, now, Kathy, I put you on the spot earlier, and I'm going to put you on the spot again. I thought that your bison was fabulous. In fact, just talking to you, I'd like to have more of it for dinner, you know. But I have had bison that has not been that great, and this is an issue. Explain that to us.
Okay. So the bison industry, as I said, is a very niche industry. It's made up of a lot of independent producers. And everybody goes, raises their animals differently. There is no standards like gradations like you would have in beef. So in beef, for example, there's choice, there's select, things of that nature. But you do not have that in the bison industry. So how does one choose, you know, what is the right product to purchase? The first thing they should look for is to make sure that it's USDA inspected. And that would be noted on the package label. And that really ensures a safe product. So that's number one. At High Plains, we really work very, very hard on establishing, where we put our ranches. So when we chose our ranches, we wanted to make sure that there were natural grasses widely available, good water access, and we did an analysis of the mineral content of the grasses and then all of the additional feed that was available on a free choice basis complemented that. We also, the other thing that we do differently than other people don't do is we do a natural chill process. So when the and we also have a vertically integrated processing area. So the animals arrive to our processing plant alive, and they're completely everything happens at that processing plant. What other people do is they'll have one slaughterhouse and then a different location for a processing plant, and they'll use a different method to cool down the carcass. We believe doing a natural chill process is maintains the integrity of the product, and that it creates a higher eating experience. So we, you know, we take it takes longer. We add different steps into a process, but we believe it makes a difference, and we call that out on our package.
Now, you talked about nutritional benefits. The other issue, which is very, very, it's a great concern to everybody now, except our current president, is the environmental benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you said there are many environmental benefits to letting the bison graze and yeah. grow naturally, right?
Yeah. Bison are a wild animal. I mean, the best way to raise bison is to leave them alone. They, you do not want to get near a bison.
Yeah, I watched that. Do you ever watch that show where it has this vet who works in the Yukon or someplace? And she occasionally gets, involved with bison for some reason. I don't know why. She said you have to really separate the patient out from the herd and be careful that the herd doesn't turn on you.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're wild animals. And so, they also, you know, they're best on open grasses, wild open plains, and their hoofs are quite strong and permeate the grassland, and so it kind of creates like a you aerate your lawn. So it and the bison also eat the grass up until the very, you know, they don't go all the way down to the root like a lot of animals will. Eat the grass all the way down to the root, and then the grass dies. It has no way to regenerate itself. So bison really help regenerate the plains very, very well. Just
how do they know about that? How do they understand that?
I don't know. I mean, that's just part of their natural habitat.
they're smart like pigs.
No. Or goats.
Yeah, goats.
Hey, listen, there's one important thing that we need to add before we terminate, and that's how you get some.
How you what?
Get by it. How do you run to get it?
How do you buy bison? Yeah. So bison's available pretty much in most of the grocery stores. You know, we Kroger has a pretty good private label, and we are a supplier of that. We also sell our products in the Chicago market, and we have a bunch of markets in the Northern California. But there are bison, you know, products available pretty much at most of the major grocery stores.
But your website is?
It is highplainsbison.com.
That's the place to go get your bison, ladies and gentlemen. I can assure you, personal experience.
Well,
I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
We did. I think I'll let Peter have his sausages.
Yeah, that's the other thing is that we are one of the only producers. I think we're the only one that makes sausages with 100% protein block of bison. Other people will mix it with pork and things like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and our processor is really well known for how their sausages. They're based out of Minneapolis, and they supply a lot of very high-end, well, not high-end, but one of the popular restaurants with custom-made sausages. So they're really experts in making sausages. So we're extremely proud to have them. Our hot dogs are also the national lean meat of the Chicago Cubs. They're available at Wrigley Field.
Oh,
so we're pretty proud of that. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much.
I'm rooting for the revival of the bison, I'll tell you.
Yeah, let's go for it. Go for a million. We'll of course, if we buy more bison, that actually reduce the crop.
Well, but actually, you know, having a consumer demand for it helps the rancher then decide, you know, they have to make a living. And
sure.
So it's better. We're all in for growing the bison industry.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Kathy, we really enjoyed talking to you. Informative and helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay, so there you have it for the bison. Now, don't go away, because we'll be right back with more animals.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we have Christopher Hersheimer and Melissa Hamilton of Canal House in New Jersey. And we've interviewed them before, but they are always up to something new, and they're going to be telling us about it. The animal that Peter was referring to was they were just visiting the area to visit the Jamison Farms, where there are, of course, little lammy poos. So, anyhow, let's listen to what's up with Christopher and Melissa. Well, we have a lot to talk about to Christopher Hersheimer and Melissa Hamilton from the Canal House. Oh, there's so many things going on in your lives, you two. We're going to start with, give our listeners just a brief introduction to the Canal House.
Okay, we'll be happy to. This is Christopher, and you know, we just, Canal House is Melissa, and the two of us do, everything around food. We, are food mad, and we have a studio, and we write about food, and we photograph food, and we blog about food, and we cook food, and we talk food, and we shoot other people's books, and we help them write their books. And we, under Canal House Cooking, and also another book called Canal House Cooks Every Day, we have 9 books under the Canal House umbrella.
That's a lot.
Now, where are you geographically?
Well, this is Melissa speaking. We're in Milford, New Jersey, right on the Delaware River, and that's in Hunterdon County, just across the Delaware River from Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
That's
so it's
pretty.
A beautiful river valley, and I'm looking at the river as we speak. It's a beautiful, lazy river.
and you row across and think of George Washington, right?
Oh, just a little north of where George Washington crossed. So, yeah.
Well, so things are rolling right along at the Canal House, I gather, but you're expanding your activities. Well, one is I wanted to talk to you about you were just in our neck of the woods starting to photograph Suki and John Jamison's book that's going to be coming out late summer, early fall, and you were at their farm, and we love that farm. Jamison Farm. They grow organic lamb. Tell us about your experience there just a few days ago.
Yeah, it was over the Memorial weekend, and it's a little bit like being in that time has stood still. We were there for 3 days. We never left the property, the farm, the rolling hills all around us. It has to be the most lush green time of the year. Plus, with the rain that we've been having, it's even more lush than ever. And not we listened to serious 1970s music and cooked and took photographs and ate and laughed and talked. It was just the best.
Yeah, they're fun. Suki and John both are fun. So,
and that part of the world, you know, your part of Pennsylvania mm-hmm. versus our part of Pennsylvania, you know, in Bucks County, the roads kind of follow the creeks. And so we're along the river until it's all following creeks and it's and the trees come over and you're sort of down in the hollows until you get back up. You know, but you sort of follow, your roads follow the ridges, so you have these beautiful views over these unbelievable fields, and so everyone always says when they drive across Pennsylvania how extraordinarily beautiful it is, and we love where we are, we think it just takes our breath away when you drive, and you're going from one place to the other. It's never a chore. But where you are in western Pennsylvania around that Latrobe area, oh, my goodness, that is really spectacular. It's such a beautiful area.
When my mother was here, the thing that astounded her most was that there are trees that go to the very top of all the hills. And I said, Mom, but it's called Pennsylvania. I was never actually sure whether she got that or not.
Well, you know, on the early, I've read a series of books about the early pioneers in Pennsylvania, and the forests were so dense that you could not, walking through them, tell if it was night or day because there were so many trees.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And then,
but all that
clear.
Beautiful. Oops, sorry.
That's okay. Then they had to clear all those trees for farming. But
yes.
But they haven't wiped them out. And then
so that's why we were lucky to be there right now, because we photographed also for Suki and John's book, and the everything is so lush, as Melissa said, and green, and all the sheep were just munching and munching away and eating this beautiful grass. And then Suki noticed on one of our jaunts, oh, go to that field because there's white clover and red clover.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that's what makes the lamb so delicious, because it's only eating the best. They raise it on grass and not, you know, and the animals have such a beautiful life, you know, out in the open, in the beautiful air, in these fields, just grazing, not the way a lot of lamb is raised, which is in feedlots, just eating corn. And that's why it doesn't taste the way that the Jamison's lamb tastes.
Jamison's lamb is exquisite, I know. And they were pioneers, I think, in that,
yes,
that system of moving the flocks. Are they flocks?
Yeah, they're flocks.
Yes.
Flocks.
Yeah.
They're calling it intensive farming, and John mentioned, I think that might be a plaque on the side of the barn, preserved farm, intensive farming. And so John was telling us a little bit about that rotation, that the sheep will graze and then he'll move them to the next pasture, and then, and sort of, you know, it has that wonderful cycle, that by the time, you know, the sheep need to come back to the first one, it's, the grass is high again and ready for them. So, and they've got the border collies to help, you know, it's so fun because like, working animals.
Yeah.
The dogs, so smart.
They are smart, by the way. I mean, it's been proven that they have, that they're smarter. Not all animals are created equal in intelligence, and the herding animals really are smart. So, now, did you photograph the farm itself, the buildings, the lambs, or what?
Well, mostly we did that when we could, but mostly what we photographed was the food for the book, which was wonderful. Suki's tried and true recipes, and it's true home cooking, which is what we do for Canal House.
Mm-hmm.
We're writing a new book, too, that'll be out next spring, and it is all home cooking, which is what we do. So we loved Suki's food, which are all these great recipes that her family has loved. And so they're very simple, and they allow the ingredients to sort of shine through, and they're homey and good, and they're what that family, the Jamison family, has loved over the years. So there's only, maybe 23 recipes, but they have each story has these wonderful stories that John has written.
Oh, John's stories are wonderful.
Yes, has an accompanying recipe, and so when you make the recipe, you'll never forget the story.
And when does this get a title, or does it have one already?
Oh, it does have a title. Is it Coyotes at the
Back Door or something? Yes.
Yeah, Wolves at the Back Door. It's a great,
It sounds very strange, actually.
Yes, well, it sounds like an MFK Fisher title.
It's
more literary than... What's so great is they're doing the book themselves, and so they can do anything they want. You know, they don't have a whole marketing team trying to figure out what the title should be based on I don't know what. But it's very original and... just full of the artistry of both of them,
Now, what are you going to put in your new cookbook, then?
Well, our book is going to be quite a tome.
Really?
we just sort of keep adding, and we have, our publishers are, we have the wonderful Michael Salakis. Michael Serban.
Yeah.
Michael Serban at Little Brown, and he is, he just is so, it's like the more the better, and he just is so indulgent of us. And
that's
so
unusual. That's very unusual.
I know it is, but he says he likes what we're doing. And so because we photograph and write, we do everything at the same time, so they're quite integrated. So as we're making something, we can take pictures of how we do it, and so it really tells people if they don't cook or if they want to be better cooks or if they're just interested in cooking as we are, we always like to see, well, how does that person boil an egg? Or no matter how simple it is, I'm sure it's the same for you, Anne. You like to know, well, how do they do that, right? And this book will tell you how you do it, how we do it.
So you're going to have instructional photographs as well?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
No.
Which is something that, which we've always had in our books, but now there'll be, this one will be, have more of that. You know, it's everybody's so visual now, right? Everyone's always looking at photographs. So, hey, one of the things that we do, and we do well, so why not give them what we do?
Now, do you actually have a recipe for boiling an egg?
Yes.
Oh.
You know, we didn't think that you needed one. We're such intuitive cooks, and And one time in the studio, you know, because, you know, we are in both intuitive and also, you know, you could have a rhythm, a pattern of how you do something. So, oh, you're going to make eggs. You're going to boil some eggs, and you'll put the eggs in the water, and you'll bring it to a boil, and then you'll go and make yourself a cup of coffee and a piece of toast and butter. And by the time that's all done, you know, you take the egg out, and sometimes it's a little more cooked, sometimes a little less, but you have your system. But anyway, one time we said, well, how long actually is that? How long does it take? So we did, we just ran sort of a series of tests, and do you put the egg in when the water is simmering, or do you start timing after the, you know, do you put the eggs in when it's cold water and then bring it up to a simmer? So we, you know, we went through the whole nine yards on how to boil an egg. And
well, we did that. We had Kenji. What's Kenji's last name?
Lopez.
Oh, Kenji Lopez. Uh-huh.
And we thought we knew everything about boiling eggs. Because that
he takes it to the edge.
But he's wonderful.
He's
absolutely correct. The amazing thing is he's actually absolutely correct. If you put a jumbo American egg in boiling water and cook it for 7 minutes and 20 seconds, it is absolutely perfect.
Yes, for soft-boiled eggs.
For a soft-boiled egg.
And if you, for soft-boiled eggs,
and if you want a hard-boiled egg, you do it for 12 minutes. And the other remarkable thing is that if it's a fairly fresh egg, the shell will come right off. And if you're using
if it's a fresh egg, actually, it will stick.
Oh, is it?
You know, so that's one of the troubles. And so you can leave the eggs, you know, a week or two, which is fine.
They're easier to peel, yeah.
Easier to peel then. But what we do is we discovered that heavily salting the water remedies that. So you can take a farm fresh egg.
Really?
and put it in heavily salted water, and it will peel beautifully.
Really? So, interesting.
So I know. So I must say that the Janison book doesn't get drilled down that way, and we're thankful that they don't, because it would get in the way of a good story.
Yes.
Just to, you know, to go on and on about how to boil an egg. But our book we're touching on all that sort of methodology. But then there's parts of our new book, which the title at the moment is Canal House Cook Something. There's parts that, you know, since we're on the egg, once you know how to cook the egg or boil it or scramble or make your omelet or whatever, we give then just a lot of recipes that you can either do what we're suggesting or riff off on your own. You know, we like it when people get a feel for how they want the recipe to be, and then hopefully they'll make it their own. Maybe they don't like fresh tarragon.
Yeah, that
maybe
seems
like
to be a trend. Everybody giving a little push so that you can use your own imagination for variations. Now, I had some shocking news from Suki Jamison a while back, which is another reason I wanted to talk to you, is are you really thinking of opening a restaurant?
Is that shocking?
Well, I did that once.
You did it once.
Well, we've done it
too.
As well.
So
yeah,
it's open.
But we know, and we keep, when we say it, we sort of, our voices go quiet, and then we kind of say, well, yes, we're going to open a restaurant, because we're a little bit, it will be our way, let's put it that way. So we're going to do something, and it will be offering food to the public. You can see how we're hemming and hawing.
You know, when you fill out those, when you have to fill out those forms that describe what your profession is, And, you know, sometimes it's hard to do because, you know, we do so many different things, but all in the food, you know. So the for this category, I think maybe we would say we'll be in the hospitality business.
Okay.
But whether it'll be a restaurant per se is not, we're not sure, but we will be
letting you know, Anne.
Okay.
Into
so
it's
not a critical about to happen state.
Yes.
Not
anyway,
yet.
We're looking forward to welcoming people and taking Canal House public and being we'll continue doing our books as well. We'll probably be seasonal so that in the dead of winter when nobody wants to leave and there's a flake of snow in the air, no one will get in their car. You know, that's the perfect time for us to settle into
take a vacation to somewhere with
the
beach.
Right. Right. We could write from the beach, couldn't we, Christopher?
We could try that.
Well,
yeah.
You know, the spirit of the Canal House is what has gained you such a following, and it's warm and welcoming, and and so I'm expecting that your restaurant will be the same, right?
That's just what we really want. We really
I
want to
take
do
warm
that.
And welcoming classes. Jesus. No. Yes, that's what we're hoping for, Anne.
Well, I can hardly wait to see where all this goes. Again, listeners, keep tuned in to the activities of Christopher Hersheimer and Melissa Hamilton, the Canal House, and good luck to you in all these ventures. So I can't wait
thank
to see
you.
the Jambison's
well,
book.
Thank you, Western Pennsylvania, and from Eastern Pennsylvania, we send our love.
Oh, great. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Seems everyone these days who's serious about cooking wants to know the hows, the whats, and the whys of the process. Now, some people might cotton to the multi-volume modernist cuisine, but a lot of us aren't quite up to it. And so, here we come with Jessica Gavin, whose book, Easy Culinary Science, explains everything in the most direct and simple way imaginable. Jessica Gavin, you have written a very useful book called Easy Culinary Science, which you might think is an oxymoron, but it's not the way you present it. You're setting out to provide recipes for everyday meals made easier, faster, and more delicious, more nutritious, and these recipes are within reach of the home cook. And that is the point, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I really wanted, the goal for the book was to really help home cooks build confidence in the kitchen through science. And, you know, they use science every day, every time they step into the kitchen, but they just may not be aware of it. And I think that this really brings the science to the surface in a very helpful, approachable manner.
Now, you have credentials. You are a certified culinary scientist and a food science industry professional, and I never knew that these categories, qualifications
existed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things that you don't really learn is an opportunity or a career path when you're in high school. You know, it's either, okay, you could go the direct culinary arts route or hospitality management, but there is, you know, food science, and a lot of the things that you buy from the grocery store, say your favorite box of cereal, your favorite chips or dip is, you know, developed by hand-in-hand with food scientists. So it's a very interesting industry.
And most of the people who work in it work for people who produce food in quantity? Is that the idea? I mean, after all, if you're only producing a dish at a time, then you don't apply much science to it. But if you're producing cornflakes, I guess you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you're looking to mass produce a large amount of food that's going to be sold, to different parts of the country or internationally. You want to make sure that if the quality of the food is going to be, at the standard level that you want, and you want to make sure the food is safe. So there's a lot of things to take into consideration when you're developing food for the mass market.
It's really funny. We had a guest on the program probably 10 years ago now. He and his friend decided that they wanted to make bacon that was kosher.
Oh, yeah.
and one of their fathers was a food scientist. So they said, Dad, can you come up with some kind of chemical composition that will mean it will taste and smell like bacon, but it's really kosher, so we can sell it into the religious marketplace.
Wow, were they successful?
They were so disgustingly successful. they made bacon into everything. I think they made bacon in shaving cream, bacon in toothpaste,
chapsticks. Yeah, bacon chapstick. Oh yeah.
Oh, so you must be a flavor chemist.
I think they were perverted.
Wow.
I think it's the answer.
I never knew anything about the flavor chemists until I read about how McDonald's did something or other with their fries. I mean, it was, they did something special to make them irresistible, but it was not, it was something that was a chemical rather than a natural product.
Oh, well, they are very irresistible, so they must have done a good job with the formula.
So now, how did you organize this book?
So I really wanted to approach it in almost like a culinary school style. So instead of looking at, recipes based on eating occasion, I wanted to really teach the most essential techniques that I learned over the years in my culinary arts training and food science and all, being in industry. So I took it each chapter by essential cooking technique, whether it be dry heat cooking, moist heat cooking, slow cooking, chemical leavening, so that, people could be really aware of, they're performing these types of culinary arts, like, all the time in the kitchen, but they could actually kind of pair, like, oh, this is, like, stir frying, I'm doing dry heat cooking, and this is the reason why I would, cook it in this manner to get a certain result. So each chapter teaches you the basics about that technique and things to look out for, and then followed up by a lot of really approachable recipes so that you can actually apply what you learn directly into the food that you make.
And now, your heritage is Asian and your husband's is Italian. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, so you have recipes with both origins included. I guess I'm just sort of heading towards making sure that the listeners understand that not only is this a reference sort of for science, but also has delicious recipes.
Yes, absolutely. So when I was thinking about what types of recipes I wanted to include into the cookbook, a lot of it was influenced by, some of the nostalgic recipes I grew up with that, either my grandparents made or that my husband's grandparents made, so that we could also almost have this legacy, recipe within the cookbook for our friends and for our family and for our children, so they could reference in the future. And it's those recipes that I feel like bring a lot of joy and comfort to people. So I really wanted to share things that were also, personal to my culinary journey as well.
Now, can you pick out something where the science behind it would make the difference if somebody were cooking it knowing the science behind it in terms of the finished product?
Yeah, absolutely. So just for example, I included, you were talking about my husband, but he encouraged me to include his grandma's meatball recipe. And I think everyone has, a recipe that their family has made for generations, but perhaps not always knew why you added certain ingredients together. It just knew, like, by feel and by taste and texture, it was just the right, you know, consistency of their meatball. So, essentially, you know, when you're making meatballs, you know, the whole goal is you don't want it to be dry or, you know, tasteless. So a couple of things you could do is you can add, you know, people add breadcrumbs and eggs all the time, but they might not know that, you know, adding a breadcrumb essentially creates a panade, which is a mixture of bread and liquid to create a starch. And when the starches are blended into the meatball mixture and then cooked, it creates this matrix inside the meatball to kind of seal in a lot of the juices and the flavors and to help with a nice, really, like, cuttable texture that's got nice consistency. So there's things like that that you may be doing already, but you didn't realize, like, what the actual function behind the ingredient was. So that's kind of an example of, you know, how knowing a little bit of the science can help you in your cooking and help you adjust as well, you know, if you wanted to modify anything in your recipe.
Now, what about something from your background?
I said
there are lots. I'm sure there's
oh,
lots.
Oh, yeah, there's great.
we can only pick one or two. We only have a certain amount of time available.
Oh, yeah. So there's a recipe in here from my grandma that I had to ask my aunt about because, you know, nothing was measured, as I said before. But it's my grandma's famous Chinese sticky rice. And the science behind that is the reason why you might, you know, choose different types of rice to give you the stickiness, but not too sticky where, you know, it's a big mush pile. So I balance the ratios of two different types of rice. And I also, my grandma always washed her rice, you know, and she would, you know, do it methodically every day and, like, soak it, and we'd wonder why. So I finally got the chance to really sit down and think about that, and it's, you know, to wash off extra starches so that, you know, the rice doesn't become too sticky and it stays nice and fluffy, you know, and has, like, the perfect texture if it's been able to soak for a little bit. So things like that, those are, like, the types of tips I would give in each recipe. So there's always a cook tip and a recipe science that would be paired with every recipe that's in the book.
I thought the secret with the rice was you bought a rice cooker.
Yeah.
We use that too, for sure.
Yeah. How do you accommodate all these new kitchen gadgets, like the Instant Pot and the slow cooker and the pressure cooker and all that, and the rice cooker? And you could just go on and on and on. And pretty soon everything's going to be computerized in the kitchen also.
You're right. I know. I do that more, I would say. Like, I have a food website, you know, jessicagavin.com, and I definitely try my best to stay on top of, you know, what are, like, the latest and hot new tools, because people have a lot of questions of how to do electric pressure cooking or, you know, how to adapt a recipe for different size slow cookers and things like that. So for the cookbook, I try to stick to things that, you know, mostly people would have on hand already in their kitchen, nothing too, you know, quirky or whatnot. It's like, oh, if you have a pot, you have a frying pan, you know, cast iron, you're mostly going to be good. But I do have a slow cooker section and, you know, details about how to use a slow cooker. But I think definitely in the future, you know, it wouldn't hurt to kind of cover something with the Instant Pot or electric pressure cooking as well.
Right. Well, I mean, it's happening. I don't quite understand why a lot of this stuff is necessary, because I don't find cooking that difficult. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, when they start talking about controlling your oven with your cell phone from out of state or something, I don't know. They lose me altogether. So.
Well, you can definitely control your slow cooker from your phone now. So you could really be totally, you know, set it and forget it and come home and your meal's ready to go and you can track it like you would track your kids or something, you know.
See, we go back the old-fashioned way. So there was a famous occasion when I was flying in from out of town and Anne was supposed to pick me up at
That was awful.
The airport that's now called Reagan Airport, was called Washington D.C.'s airport. She was supposed to pick me up. Something happened to the car, so it ground to a halt. She couldn't pick me up, and she forgot that she had put the oven timer on.
Programmed the oven for cooking the chicken.
I don't think either one of us had ever had an oven with a timer before.
Well, no, but not only that. I mean, I don't trust it now. I mean, it was like a total burnt mess. It's a wonder it didn't burn the house down.
Yeah, right.
Well, no setting and forgetting the oven for you, Anne.
That's for sure. Well, you know, you must have gotten something right with this book because the testimonials or endorsements, I guess they're called, come from some really serious science people like Nathan Myhrvold, who's like Mr. Modernist Cuisine. And I told you before that I adore Kenzie, you know, and he likes it. And then I laughed when Jean-Georges von Gerichten said he didn't know anything about it. He didn't know anything about the science behind any of the stuff he was doing.
So. Yeah, no, I definitely am very honored to have their support with the book, especially since, you know, we all have a little bit of a geeky, you know, science interest. So it's definitely great to have them be able to see the book before it was published and have their blessing, I would say.
Yes.
What would you say are a couple of the more unusual things? There's a culinary scientist you found out, and then you discovered that most people don't know them.
Oh, that's a good stumper. Wow.
No, wait, take a minute. Take a minute.
No, I think that's a really great question. I mean, I think there's, like, just the basics of, you know, like, just why you would... Maillard browning, for example, like the purpose of browning, you know, say the skin on a chicken or a steak, you know, before you fully cook it or braise it, you know, because it develops more flavor. Like it might feel like, oh, I'm just doing an extra step. I might have to cook, you know, I might have to wash a few more dishes, but really, you know, the contrast and the flavor development and the texture development, it's an easy way to, you know, enhance the flavors in your food without, you know, adding a lot more ingredients, you know, or adding too much to it. So I think just the simple methods of like, hey, you know, let's get back to enjoying the cooking and watching the process and like seeing, you know, why you would do something and understand why, you know, instead of rushing everything, you know, I feel like we're always wanting to do everything so quickly nowadays, but sometimes you can't rush flavor, you know.
Well, now, here's one for you, and I don't know where we found this, but it was in one of Thomas Keller's cookbooks. And Thomas Keller, of course, is the god of chefs. But somewhere in a little corner of one of his more elementary cookbooks, there was this secret to how to get the skin on your chicken really crisp.
Oh, yeah.
And he said the secret is you leave it uncovered in the refrigerator for preferably at least a day. And then, and what happens then is the air circulates in the refrigerator. It actually dries off the surface of the chicken. So if you do that, then you're going to get crispy chicken, whereas if you don't unwrap it until it's time to cook it, and it's covered in wet, gooey stuff, and your chicken will never get crispy skin.
That's a good tip. I remember seeing that from his classic roasted chicken recipe, yeah.
That's it. That's where he got it from, I guess.
Yeah, no, now, it totally makes sense.
Now, who taught him that? Maybe you did.
No, I wish that I had the chance to talk to Thomas Keller and tell him, you know, some tips in the kitchen, but I think he would know a lot more than I did.
Well, I think you've really elevated the possibilities for everyday home cooks with this book.
Yes.
And I'm glad you took the time to explain all the science to us. And that you got to like science, which apparently you didn't like to start with, right?
Yeah, no, that's that's definitely, I think one of the things that I would love to encourage people is that some things may seem really intimidating. Like science to me when I was young, like, was very intimidating. I just wanted to do culinary arts. But then as I started to, you know, begin on my food science journey, I just realized that, like, culinary science and food science go hand in hand, you know? Like, if you want to really understand the why behind what you're doing, then there is an explanation with science, you know? Or, you know, testing, like, you know, like the chicken example that Peter had said, like, hey, let's see how the chicken skin would be if I dried it out in the refrigerator versus took it directly out, just patted the top, and then put it in the oven. Like, let's test the results. So it's really just having fun in your own test kitchen and seeing if you can, you know, get the results you're desiring, and you can reproduce it time and time again.
Well, again, listeners, it's Easy Culinary Science for Better Cooking by Jessica Gavin. Can you give your website one more time, Jessica?
Yes, you could find me at www.jessicagavin.com.
And you keep it up to date with lots of interesting tips for easy, simple science and cooking, right?
Absolutely. So that's my website is definitely where you'll find all of, like, the latest and greatest how-tos, you know, science tips, what else? Recipes, everything is there, you know, basic techniques, everything there that you would need to succeed in the kitchen.
Well, thank you for the book, and thank you for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time. Thank you, Anne and Peter.
Bye, Jessica.
Bye. Take care.
Okay, sweetheart, I think that's it for this week, and we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week, and until then,
bye-bye.